Hi everyone, Ian Gardner here with another fabulous episode of Open the Podbay Doors. Ripper of an episode today, we had Lauren Hall from Ivy, which is a venue and event management software company. It's based out of the Gold Coast. Lauren, originally from South Africa, came over here, I think 15, 20 years ago. Some pretty traumatic experiences in her South African life that she shares, and some real stories of tenacity and hustle. The reality is, like, her business in that space, when COVID hit, it kind of stopped. Every one of our customers, you know, restaurants, clubs, stadiums, hotels, their revenue just fell off a cliff and nobody knew what was going to happen. She managed to keep her head, keep her staff, and has come out the other side better and stronger. I mean, to me, that's just a remarkable story of talent and resilience and success. And look, this is a great interview with a great and really strong woman. A lot of respect for Lauren. So I hope you enjoy this conversation. All right, everyone, welcome to the show. I am delighted. It's been a long time coming, this interview, to be joined by Lauren Hall, all the way from the Gold Coast. And Lauren runs a business called Ivy, which is in the events management software space. She's a member of the Summit Group. I think I've known you for 5 or 6 years, Lauren. I think we've always got on pretty well. It turns out we're pretty much the same age.
Scary.
And I loved your business. Yeah, I know. Loved your business and backstory. But anyway, welcome. Like, we have been trying to do this for a little while, but COVID got in the way and a whole bunch of other things. So yeah, delighted that you could make it this time.
Thanks, Ian. I really appreciate you having me. Hopefully we can give some of our audience some golden nuggets to take away at the end of the journey.
Yeah, no, it's always good to get you talking to start with, because people then get a perception that where your accent is from. So you are South African once upon a time. So how did you end up in Australia? And then we'll maybe jump back to South Africa and your background there.
Yeah, well, I think that it's actually quite an interesting story. Obviously, we were always looking from South Africa to move to another location. And when I was competing in Taekwondo at the time of my career in South Africa, I had gone to Russia and competed in the World Championships. And I had met the captain of the Australian team. And needless to say, managed to head into Australia the following year in a very wild romance, passed through Melbourne and into the Northern Territory, and had this whirlwind of an experience. And about 2 years later, following on that, I had actually met my husband. Obviously, long distance relationships didn't work out. And having been in South Africa for most of my life, and we were looking to make the decision to move cross continent for the safety of our children and to look at new opportunities, the first thing I thought of was Australia was a really great country to come to. It had everything we were looking for from a business opportunity, a lifestyle, and it was, close to the beach, particularly because I married a man who loves the water, and I had two young boys that all love fishing, boating, and surfing. And I thought, well, if anywhere we're going to go, we're going to go to, Australia. But the funny part of it was that when I passed through Surfers Paradise in the Gold Coast, not knowing the area very well at all, and having made the association with my husband that surfed, thinking Surfers Paradise was actually where you surf, that was kind of, well, we can go there because you can get the waves and we can build a business. And it was the most unrelated reason why we were actually in the Gold Coast completely. But coming to Australia was probably the best decision we ever made, and it certainly is one that I look on with pride to be here now as an Australian citizen.
I mean, a lot of your story, which I hope to get into, is just the story of tenacity and resilience. You know, you've had some pretty hard knocks, and, you know, I don't know whether that's because, you know, you were a pretty fantastic Taekwondo fighter, from what I understand. You were, you know, in the South African, were you a South African champion, or you were certainly in the team and did the world champs?
Yep, both.
I mean, is the tenacity that you have, how much of that is linked to the fact that you can take a punch in the face and give it back, and how much was did that encourage you to get into that sport?
I think that I've always been extremely competitive in everything that I did in life, and from starting my first businesses, I think what Taekwondo actually gives to you as an individual is not just the ability to handle conflict, but it actually gives you an enormous amount of ability to deliver control and a lot of discipline within your business or within a sporting environment. And I think you find that as you look at across successful business entrepreneurs, how many of them have actually been in competitive sports, that definitely is brought into the business world because it is kind of a code of conduct that people just generally work towards. I think it's been a huge influence of my life in terms of, you know, performance, competitive, wanting to win, never giving up, a real indomitable spirit that I believe I bring to every business that I build.
Can we maybe jump back to, you know, your life in South Africa? And you know, South Africa is a tough place. I mean, you even see what's going on now, and it's heartbreaking. You know, it was ravaged by COVID, and now the place is sort of being rioted, you know, raised to the ground in some senses. But when you were there, it was pretty bad too, and you had some pretty bad experiences when you were there, which I think partly influenced in your desire to come. So maybe tell us a little bit about your life in South Africa.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think with any person coming from South Africa, it's always a very difficult environment. I mean, there was no government support, no medical support. Everything you did when you set up a business, you had to own that process. If you didn't make money, you didn't survive. And that's just the survival instinct that is now built into you in your DNA. The challenge I had, you know, I was a serial entrepreneur. I built Ivy's my fifth, four multi-million dollar companies along my journey since I was 17. Through that, I did, you know, martial arts manufacturing of clothing, pharmaceuticals, fast moving consumable goods, and then a technology company where I was building a meetings platform for the industry. During my journey when I was 23, that was a really hard time because at that point in time, we were attacked at home by five black guys that came into our house and they murdered my father in front of me. It was a really, really traumatic experience that really set on the path around, well, this is the environment we live in. It wasn't just one incident. You know, I'd been attacked again following year, you know, gone through a pretty bad torture with my husband and my young baby. There was lots of motivations. We'd lost three to murder in my family, uncle and grandfather and father. So there was an enormous threat around survivability. The choice to actually leave to come to Australia, we knew we wanted to come. We just had to get there. It took us 5 years in applying through South African government for immigration to get to Australia. Following on from, I had just built the meetings platform. I had a massive adoption in terms of my tech to solve some really big problems in the industry. I had just won $10 million from the South African government, 10 million rand, as you would say, in reinvesting my tech for global scale. That was awarded to me on the 29th of July. And on the 1st of August, I got accepted into Australia. So within 2 days of having the option, having funded a business right to everything I owned in realization of the dream of solving some really big problems, I got access to Australia. And it was a no-brainer. I walked away from the money, took my two young kids and husband, closed up shop, and we actually walked away from everything we had in South Africa to start again in the Gold Coast. And that was a really, really tough thing. I mean, there was no job, no money, no network. And I was in a, you know, outside of a city center to start again. But I don't regret it for 1 minute.
No. And it's an astonishing story. I remember the first time I heard it, I was like, oh my God. I mean, like it kind of goes beyond what most people can comprehend. I mean, it's almost something you'd see in a movie or it would be someone else that had gone through it, but this was you. And I think in some ways it feels to me like a lot of your tenacity, and we'll talk about that in business. I don't think it stems from that one moment and it's maybe caught up in just the person you are, but I mean, to see a member of your family murdered in front of you is just, I mean, it defies belief. I mean, that must be a moment that that lives with you for every day.
It does. I think it is a very difficult thing for most people to comprehend because particularly when you're one of four daughters and your father kind of is the pillar of strength in the family, kept the family together, I think the consequences of that type of trauma is it's so shocking that it's very hard to actually deal with. You know, the next day I actually walked into his company and took over his company. Because I knew that if I didn't, my entire family would suffer. And, it, you know, tragedy and trauma, I think you suffer long term. It's only time that helps you heal. There's no way to navigate through a situation like that. You embed yourself in other things to help you deal with it as a kind of healing process. And I think maybe my pursuit of business has actually been part of my therapy, to be honest. Yeah. Because in South Africa, you don't have victim support. You don't have psychologists to help you deal with it because the crime rate is so high. It's worse than the Vietnam War every year.
Yeah. And it's a point, you know, you must look at what's happening now and just, I don't know how you think, I mean, what is your view as to what's happening now? I mean, is the country just a basket case that will never get out of this cycle of violence and despair, or is there light at the end of the tunnel?
Look, I think it's just on a landslide to destruction. I think we always saw that. We anticipated, we actually expected some of these riots and xenophobia stuff that was happening in South Africa to be actually earlier on, you know, even change at the change of the guard in the presidencies. And but there is such a huge conflict between all the different nationals within the countries in language and culture that it's just a natural, it's a boiling pot. And, you know, there's still the anti-apartheid regime that makes the people that are still living there suffer for all the forefathers' decisions. And it doesn't matter what you do, you will constantly be in that environment. And I think South Africa is going to struggle to come through this.
Yeah. And it also strikes me that, I mean, you've built a support network around you. I mean, it seems that you've got a great relationship. I mean, I see your posts on Facebook and, you know, you seem very happily married and you've got a couple of kids that you love to death and, you know, your lifestyle seems idyllic. I mean, is that true? And, you know, how important is that to, you know, to solving those wounds?
Do you know what I think what happens to you, Ian, is that when you go through things that are so enormous in your life, the things that actually really mean the most are the people around you. It's your family, it's your friends, it's the people that add value to your life. When we were robbed and everything was taken from us, our cars and every item, everything you owned was removed, you actually lose that connection in the value in the materialistic things. And I think going through all of the different struggles that I've been through, I said when we came to Australia, we wanted to have a life that could encourage, you know, a lifestyle that would be healthy and also one that would be happy. You know, you can strive to be very successful in your businesses. You can do it anywhere in the world today because of the ability to do tech and things are so available to you. But I think the journey around the personal growth and the way that you see the world and you see and how you navigate through problems that are really difficult, not only in your business and personal life, it's how you come through. You grow the most in the most difficult of circumstances. And it takes a lot of courage and a lot of confidence in yourself and belief to really step forward in a world of business, having come through what I've come through and overcome a lot of adversity. But the lifestyle that we chose, I think is important for you to get a balance because the world of business is very, very hectic now that we're so connected on technology today because you live and eat and sleep business 24 hours a day.
Yeah. I want to jump on to the business, but before I do, like, just I wouldn't mind just a quick deep dive into the Taekwondo. You know, because look, it's a martial arts, it's an Olympic sport. It's not, you know, we're recording this on the 30th of July, so Taekwondo I don't think has been at the Olympics, which are on right now, which is kind of a strange Olympics, I have to say. It's just odd seeing the place without any crowds.
It is.
But you know, it's amazing. So, I mean, why did you choose Taekwondo as a pastime? And, you know, why did you then decide to become exceptional at it?
I think, firstly, I chose Taekwondo because I had a natural born fighting spirit and I wanted to win. And I think it was driven by two things. Number one, self-defense in a country that was extremely violent, that I could actually defend myself in a circumstance, which I had multiple times. It came to really bear a positive impact in saving my life. Okay. And secondly is having the ability. I have always, through everything I've ever done, is strived for excellence. I never, ever wanted to be second. I wanted to be first. I wanted to be the best in my country. If I take on something, it's all in. It's never half-mast. And I took that view with Taekwondo because I thought, well, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it 150% committed. I wanted to be the undefeated champion in South Africa, which I became for 2 years. I wanted to be a Springbok and get my colors, and I wanted to compete in a world international event and on the global playing field. And I did that, and I got to Russia. I competed in Japan, got my black belt and second degree in Australia. And and I think where you look at this, it becomes almost part of life and the way you live your life. And having that discipline, I think helps you navigate through a lot of different issues that you don't see coming in your life.
Yeah. And worst injury, or can you tell us a story about Taekwondo that will make us all squirm?
Yeah, well, I'll never forget my blue belt grading. It was the first time I had to break boards, and I refused to give up. One of the things they said, well, you've got 3 boards to break, and it was a front fist punch. And you practice on these boards that are probably 2 inches thick, and you get it right, but it's got a very broken line that helps you pass through the pressure points. In my blue belt grading, I punched through the 3 boards, but I didn't get through it, and I broke my hand. And I said, well, I still, in order to get my A grading so that I could get a jumper rank, I had to get through the board, and I still went through it and with a broken hand and broke the boards, okay, so that I could ensure I got my A grading, which I did. And that was very early on, before I even got to black belt, because black belt really is the beginning of your career in Taekwondo. Those grounding belt ranks are really lots of just the base fundamentals in order to get you there. And there's been lots of interesting experiences. One, when I was in Worlds, and I got disqualified twice for excessive contact.
yeah, I remember that story.
Yeah. So
when you first told that, we all laughed.
Yeah, and I think that it's... but I knew I was really good. I perfected my art for my ability and my level. And I think that, you know, even if you don't win, but if you got disqualified, I executed upon my plan really well, and, you know, helped ranked South Africa in our performance in that championship.
Yeah. I mean, look, the trend now seems to be away from the sort of more formal martial arts. I mean, I think in the UK, one of the most popular, you know, pastimes in that sort of punching, kicking area is MMA. In fact, my son goes to the local MMA gym, and it just doesn't, I mean, what's your view on that?
If I was a boy, I would have been in MMA. Okay. And I know right. that you got Ronda Rousey, and I watched the UFC. I am an absolute fan, only because of the fact that I was very fortunate, because I had a martial arts manufacturing company in South Africa. It was my start in the world of this industry. I manufactured for every style. I got to the privilege of actually launching that UFC in South Africa with the team, where I was making all the items and things like that. It was a really fantastic journey. But I think martial arts are evolving today because of the fact that it's not just stand-up fighting. You've got to understand ground styles. You've got to be able to defend yourself. Most fights go to the ground within 30 seconds. If you're in a pub, you're hit in the face and you're on the ground. And you need to be able right. to understand how to deal with you know, an attack, or, you know, you get into a very difficult situation. You're on the ground. And I trained, and I think back to, I trained in jiu-jitsu. I trained with the Machado brothers when they came over, in the Brazilian styles. You've got to give yourself a mix in martial arts, because you don't know the circumstance you're going to find yourself in. And the more well-rounded, I think MMA is great, because it gives you so much versatility around strength in different styles that come and you can perform under one set of rules.
We should talk about, we're over 15 minutes in. I love talking about sport and non-business stuff. And look, I think that's a terrific context to the business. So let's talk about Ivy. So I think you started it in 2009. It's, you know, I'll read from the website, cloud-based event management software for all sorts of venues. You've got clubs, restaurants, hotels, stadiums, other venues. You've got thousands of customers all around the world. I want to get into the COVID story, but do you want to just tell us a bit more about the business, why you started it and what it actually does right now?
Yeah, I think it actually started originally in South Africa when I got involved in the events industry by default. It wasn't something that I chose to be involved in, but I had a brand strategy and advertising company that did lots of really good digital creative solutions for very large corporations. And they would say, Lauren, well, you've done all of this really great. Can you just launch it? And can you do the event for us? And I said, well, how hard's an event? It's just good project management, great creative experience, and leave memorable takeaways for every single person that was in that and deliver along the objectives of that customer. Anyway, did some very large local and international events with big teams, organizing some massive, massive events. And it was such a problem where it took literally my teams up to 6 weeks to be able to organize an event. And that is just in, because typically today, if you wanted to find a venue, you'd have to pick up the phone and phone 10 different venues, find out if they're available, wait for somebody to respond to you, go backwards, forwards in that negotiation. And typically by the time the corporate customer would actually make the decision around which venue and the suppliers they wanted, more than 50% of them were no longer available. And I started on that journey because I thought to myself, I said there had to be an easier way to be able to organize an event, book the supply chain, lock it all down, and get on it with the delivery of that process. And I was dealing with the large corporates at the time and recognized that they did not have a meeting spend management system to aggregate their data, understand how much they were spending across their markets. They had no live real-time system that could you could have access to inventory, pricing, or availability. And I set on the journey in 2006 and built the first meetings management platform for the industry. And it took millions of dollars. It took many years of building and taking and commercializing. And all of a sudden, I hit a sticking point where the issue around scale really came to pass, where I had to roll out with very large corporations with thousands of users. And I had this issue where I now had to re-engineer it for scale. It was built in ASP Classic, not .NET, and particularly cloud technology was not developed like it is for AWS today. Okay, I wish it was.
What year is this, Lauren?
This is 2006.
Okay, so that is really early. There, you know, AWS, I think it maybe just started, but no one had heard of it and they didn't really even know what they were doing themselves.
No. And let me tell you, I wish AWS was then, because then I probably would have been very successful in South Africa. But the reality was that because it was built the way it was, I needed to re-engineer it for scale. And when I immigrated to Australia, I brought in all my IP, all my source code. And that's when I found my partner, James, my good co-founder, who was a really good tech expert, and propositioned him to be my partner to re-engineer my tech for scale. And that's when we started building, you know, we started out by building some event management technology to manage the event registration process, because we knew that the buyer needed to have a technical tool set to help them manage the process. But in order to do that, we knew we had a second phase of that business to build, which is all the venue management software, because the problem existed because 90% of the venues that today had no system. They were all paper-based and they were using calendars, Word documents to send quotes. And all we really wanted to do was sit down in front of a computer and say, I'm looking for a venue for 500 people on the 18th to the 20th of November, 3 breakout rooms, $100 a head, and I don't want prawns on the menu. I wanted that flexibility to check, are you available? And if you are, how much are you going to cost? And those two questions were the most difficult to answer, because unless you could deploy the enterprise software at the source of the supply chain, you had no way to be able to have access to that inventory or price, and you couldn't push it online. So the necessary journey we went through was to build enterprise software that could then be deployed across restaurants, hotels, be deeply integrated to their property management systems, point of sale. We built up all the booking engines to sit on the front end so we could connect the back end and the front end and become their truth of live inventory. And that's been an enormous journey over the last 10 years, where we went through that first period of 4 years of building events management software. We really pivoted all our energies into the venue side because we saw that was really sticky. There was a real value proposition, was extremely disruptive, and we were automating the entire industry sector that was manual and transforming it and then putting it online and then connecting it to the buyers. So It is a really exciting opportunity now that as we globalize, because we're not just driven restaurants and hotels, but we're doing all the stadiums in UK, you know, like Wyndham, you know, we got Wembley, we got Twickenham, we got Merlin Eye, we've got some really fantastic, iconic brands. And now we're in scaling into major casinos out of Vegas and very large enterprise type customers that have enormous needs around automation and systemization because it's never been there. And it's got such a high cost of human capital to be able to manage an event, not only from the lead to conversion point, but the entire operational back end.
Yeah. So can we jump back in time a little bit? So back to January 2020. So this time, well, not this time last year, but last January, you know, because I'd known your story to this point. I mean, I think I saw you at Heads Over Heels first at, which is, you know, a group to support women founders with their networks and other support. And I remember seeing you and thinking that was great, but that was 2014. So you built the business. It was going really well. You'd raised a bunch of money. January 2020, tell us where the business was at and what was going on in your life, because the next few months after that were pretty pivotal. But let's go back a little bit to that January.
And actually, that's very interesting you say that, because I was actually at the end of January, I was traveling in the US and I was doing a big cap raise round. And I had about 40 big investors at the table looking to commit funds to this next round of growth, which was really our growth capital.
And it's quite a big check you were looking for. I mean,
it was a $15
million. Yeah.
Yeah. And what we actually did is I appointed investment bankers. I'd gone on the whole roadshow. We had lots of really favorable investors looking to come to the party, to the table on that negotiation. Obviously arrived back early March. COVID had hit as we were coming through the US, and it was just an annihilation. And I arrived back. I said, everything had to change. We moved the entire team home in 24 hours, and we went on the next 12 months of a grueling run of restructure with our teams, making sure that we took a policy to keep all of our staff employed and to do our best to make sure that we could do that, utilizing government supports programs, not only Australia, USA, and UK. We managed to actually go into COVID, come through COVID, the impact, and come out of it stronger than what we were when we went in. And now, for me, when we went into this, it was real crisis management because there was so much uncertainty. We had thousands of our customers shutting down for 6 months, some people not opening, some not having the balance sheet to support it, removing 70 to 80% of their infrastructure in their venues, bleeding millions every single day.
Yeah, because pretty much all of your customers must have just fallen off a cliff in terms of their revenue.
Yeah.
I mean, like, so less, this is less about, I mean, you probably had some contracts in place, but even then, I mean, a contract's worth nothing if the person who is due against can't pay.
Yeah.
You know, so you must have been looking at this going, oh my God, this is the end of the world.
I felt like that. Honestly, I said, where in one's life, when you are now servicing 15 different countries with customers, that one particular scenario can affect every single country simultaneously. Okay. It was that, oh my God, moment that said, I don't know if I'm going to have a business in the next 6 months. And I took the view that it was the most important navigation of my career, that I was going to get this company through it in every single potential way, which was looking at every creditor we have, all our payrolls with our team. Our payroll never suffered. We lost one day per person globally, okay, and kept everybody employed 4 days a week. And it was such a huge navigation, partnering with our customers, understanding the pain they were going through, making payment options. Oh, it was just brutal. And it's not just, I think, the process you go through. You as a leader are responsible to keep the faith and lead your team with confidence through crisis. The mental well-beings of every individual was also really critical to me and my partner because of the fact of the impact of the emotional stress that people were going through had really affected everybody in different ways. And I think coming through COVID and this crisis and coming through and actually seeing the resurgence of the industry off the back of these last 12 months, proved that what the tech that we actually built was so robust and so strong and so valuable that what it does is COVID actually became a catalyst for us and a tailwind, because as much as we lost 200 smaller customers, particularly in the restaurant space, because they didn't have the balance sheet, they were closed down. Some of them haven't opened. We started to sign up some of the very big, larger customers that said, I need automation. I've lost 70% of my infrastructure. Okay. I need something that's going to help me manage this process, even if it is smaller in my business value, but I need systems. And we became a priority in terms of implementation and decision-making within the industry sector. So we are going to be riding that wave now, still coming through COVID with the openings of the new markets out of UK, which was the 19th of July. America obviously went into business as usual over the last couple of months. We definitely saw that US seemed to have continued to grow better than it was than Australia, which literally came to a standstill, and the same as the UK. And through that, we navigated our journey to ensure that we could still deliver product, we could still deliver support, we could still maintain revenue, even though we made adjustments to accommodate their earnings and their commitments. But we really, really came through that fighting hard. Like, honestly, yeah, it was the fight of our lives.
Yeah, and it was amazing, and well done. I mean, congrats on everything. And I think it was two or three months ago you did announce a fundraise, so yep, you managed to get that done. So tell us about that.
Yeah. So when I looked at, I actually went into, after failing of doing my capital round in March because of the fact of all the uncertainty around COVID, just everything collapsed in my round. I then decided that part of looking at where did we have the predominance around our footprint and where was our growth markets. We obviously had a lot of support in Australia, and we decided to recapitalize out of Australia and to do it as a pre-IPO round to ensure that we also had a pathway to liquidity for the investors that came in now that would get the upside of that potential growth journey. We had a lot to achieve because coming through COVID, all the damage, proving the growth. I actually, in the first start, I actually failed in my pre-IPO round because I landed up getting that round only out in early December, where there was this enormous IPO crush. And I went back to market end of February and closed my round in April. And I just feel like it's been such a tumultuous journey and in raising capital to really give confidence in that this business is really, truly investable and scalable. We have got the best teams, and we're just doubling that team out now. And it's going to be one that we can, you know, drive a pathway to profit and to get to 100 million in revenue in the next 4 years. And this capital was absolutely critical for us. So we raised, you know, 7 million Australian dollars, and I will look to raise another 25 million in April.
And so the April round, is that going to be the IPO?
That will be our IPO.
Right.
So we've started it. We've started all the prep.
Right, so yeah, I was going to say that's good. It takes a while. So this is a journey that you're on. I mean, have you got any, you haven't done this before, I don't think, have you?
No, but you know, I look at this and I suppose because I've been financially very strong and I've been the CFO and CEO of the company for the last 12 years, I think finance and good governance is a critical component of being successful in an IPO preparation. I've just appointed a new CFO. We've just appointed the auditors and attorneys. I've got a good finance team. And I think that it's about making sure you tick all the boxes and all your due diligence is done correctly and everything contract is relevant and valued. The biggest thing for us now in this changeover is the changeover of reporting standards. I think that's going to be huge for any business. You know, we're driven by different SaaS metrics and, you know, on special purpose accounting, you as a private company, you can report differently to generally accepted accounting practice and AASB standards. And we're now moving to IFRS 15 in revenue recognition. That has an impact. There's a lot of things that you have to change over on your reporting and comparative data. And that's where we're going through now into audit. That roadmap of preparation is huge. The second part is the prospectus building and building the underwriting of future investors in that round that will kick off in, you know, end of January, early Feb, to underpin the success of this round. Now, an IPO is only successful, number one, if you can prove your growth. Secondly, that you can ensure that there's market confidence in tech and that there's still confidence in the stock market, because you remember timing is everything with successful IPOs, and that you've got a valuation people feel is reasonable and it's not overinflated. Yeah. So lots of things to deal with now in this next pathway of the next 9 to 12 months.
No, Lou, it's definitely super exciting. I presume this is a Australian listing, so ASX?
Yeah, ASX.
Yeah. No, that's great. And you, so the investors were Thorney Investment Group and Gandel?
Correct.
Anything you want to say about them?
Look, I have to say I was so excited to have them on board because, you know, as much as we've been a private company, most of my rounds I haven't had any venture or, you know, really highly sophisticated, serious investors on my cap table. And one of the things I wanted to do with this round was to bring in some of that confidence and some of those bigger players. Thorney is one of the most highly respected Melbourne funds with Alex and Avi Waislitz, and they're just such fabulous people. I felt so privileged to have them as my lead investors, as cornerstone for this round. I also had the privilege of meeting Tony Gandel, drove down to meet with him when he was coming up. And really, I actually pitched him after having surgery. I just got out of surgery and drove down to meet him, still under anesthetic. And I thought to myself, the things I do as a founder, I mean, my God, I could write a book. But Tony, what a fantastic man. I'm so thrilled and so privileged to have them on as my investors. And just recently, I closed another 500,000 last week, which was another billionaire family, the Bierson family, to come in as well. And I think what this actually does for us is underpin that we're such an investable, great opportunity for in new investors to come in and see value for the future in what we're doing, and as a really disruptive tech platform that's really transforming industry. It's game changing for the whole industry worldwide.
Yeah, maybe we should just talk a little bit about the industry. And you know, we are sitting in Sydney, still in lockdown, or not still, but we are in lockdown. We've been in it for 5 or 6 weeks. And, you know, again, it's nothing compared to Melbourne. But the rest of the world is coming out. So events are coming back. But do you think the events industry has changed, or how has it changed as a result of COVID? Why don't we use that as the question?
Look, I think that it's really critical because a lot of people see the events industry having still been very manual and face-to-face, and things are changing into really hybrid different environments. The meetings sizes are going to be limited by government lockdowns and restrictions, which means you're going to have this face-to-face component and you're going to have this virtual environment, which generally today we see moving forward for at least the next 24 months as being a really hybrid type event business, which means it gives a lot of opportunity to tech companies that can offer the different layers of tech stack that they need to be able to deliver this mix of virtual plus face-to-face type events. I think venues are having to put in a lot of more COVID restricted health policies and have to adhere to different types of rules and regulations that define size and revenue, which means pricing's changing. In terms of venues and events, they're looking to drive greater yield out of smaller events and more often because they can't do some of the larger based events, depending on the region. We're definitely seeing different capacity levels where instead of having events that are sitting in CBDs, people are moving into more outskirts regions where there's less issues around confinement and numbers. So this industry is changing and is going to constantly evolve over the next 12 to 24 months. But we are seeing a massive resurgence of that face-to-face events coming back and the need for people to come together because it is such an important part of doing business and socials and weddings and things like that. It's just navigating some of the challenges around it.
Yeah, look, that's interesting. You know, because like we've wrestled, you know, we being Innovation Bay have wrestled with trying to get the right mix, you know, and what an event could or should look like. And, you know, like, thank God everything was open in May. I mean, we had a huge May and we did a big Venture Down Under conference for about 85 people from the venture industry. There was no real hybrid element to that. And it was just this, there was so much desire from the community to be back doing the face-to-face stuff. Maybe the question is, do you think that hybrid event is the future? You know, when you're putting on an event, you're seeing platforms like Hopin, which we've tried, which tries to combine a little bit face-to-face with some some online stuff. I mean, like, yeah, just if you could touch a bit more in that virtual versus real world.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Ian. I think it is still a little bit challenging. We've also participated in some virtual events, industry events in the globe, in Europe and in America, that there's still a transition I think people are going through, because the confidence around exhibitions and putting booths and tables in a virtual environment, particularly in the space where you're accustomed to having that face-to-face interaction, is still very challenging. We haven't seen the metrics of really strong success in the outcomes of that engagement within that virtual environment. I think it is where content is being delivered or streamed in a way much where Zoom is on lots of meetings that is shared, that not only you have smaller groups of networking and still that face-to-face, where you may actually run the events in multiple regions, okay, where you've got smaller groups that do come together where content is shared. I still think that there's a way for us to go in hybrid delivery of that really true online experience with events. It's as much as we have online ticketing for registrations, you have lots more tools in terms of the apps that are deploying engagements and helping you connect all of these pieces of the puzzle. We've seen that some really good tools that have come out, they're still very much in its infancy in really getting that level of support that can show good ROI for investment in events in the virtual world. It is going to continue to be a mix because of different legislative lockdowns, but people are trying to innovate and work through different strategies that people face-to-face and virtually can come together with more meaningful delivery. And that will continue to be part of what I believe the future of the events industry is going to be. Because until such time as we are through this pandemic, you know, which people are only seeing for 2024, we're going to have to adapt to some of the changes and try and work what gives the best experience for people attending that event, as well as the people being able to deliver on the value of the sponsors and all the content that, whether it's education or industry, people want to see that there's a level of return on investment.
Yeah. So, look, I mean, Ivy is a global business. I mean, you've got customers all over the world. Yeah. I mean, I suspect the majority of your revenue is coming from the US and Europe, I would have thought.
Is yeah, right? Well, it's actually quite interesting. 50% of our revenue is Australia, okay? And we've moved that shift now into where about 40%, well, it's about 37% that's sitting in the US and the balance in the UK, Europe. But as we've moved forward out of the financial year, we've seen that shift where we will sit with about 40% in both US and UK, and Australia will shift down to about 20% in the next financial year. So because there's a big changeover in terms of the size of customers that are being onboarded in our international markets in comparison to the smaller customers, but larger numbers here.
Yeah. So tying this back to a question, I mean, like we're all happy, I suppose, that, you know, we haven't had thousands and thousands of deaths from COVID in Australia. But I think, you know, we talked in this on the news podcast this week, just the frustration with the startup community. And I think the broader business community, just with the lack of clarity on when that's going to stop. You know, when will our borders be open? When can we travel again? I mean, it must be killing you, because I'm sure you want to get on a plane and go and visit your customers in the US and sell to some new ones.
Yeah.
And that must be affecting you. So, I mean, do you want to touch on that and give us an insight? Maybe you've got some insight as to when you think this is going to change.
Look, I think that firstly, once Australia has started to have an effective vaccine rollout, which we know is only really being effective from October because of the delays in supply, and there's a couple of real key issues. I don't anticipate our borders.
Yeah, although I was hearing this morning, Lauren, that there's 3 million AstraZeneca doses floating around that just no one's taking because they're mixed messaging on it. I mean, I think I'd rather have, you know, maybe not as brilliant vaccine rather than die of COVID. I mean,
yeah,
it seems a fairly simple guess.
But a lot of people don't think like that, Ian. And I think that the media play a huge role in the perceptions around what is successful and what is what should be implemented overall, including our politicians. And I think that there's such a conflict between federal and state and who's doing what. And I don't think that there's been one good, strong policy across the board for everybody. And I think we've seen that also in America. And I think going back to that question around, well, you know, until we have that, we're not going to see international travel open up to the level that we'd like to see it, which means that what do we have to do within those markets to still engage our customers, make sure we deliver on our revenue growth and ensure that we have the right people at the right levels working in those markets. And that's an investment that you have to make in people that are really acting on your behalf because you have restrictions. And that's an important part of how we're stepping in our growth cycle, building out new teams, heads of sale, people that have been in industry that can build it, build some of that thought leadership and drive some of that marketing engagement through multiple touch points. And it means that we are layering sales processes. It's lots of virtual. You'll have people that are face-to-face in region and we can come in virtually. So we're even seeing that sales process change. Okay, which typically now there's a lot more online. I think people are zoomed out, okay, to the point of they're over Zoom. And
that's for sure.
But unfortunately for all of us in all the industries, there's a lot of domestic revenue that sits within the industry sectors because of the limitations around where you can travel. So people are being forced to look in their own backyards for holidays and travel plans that they can do to see family if they are local. If not, they are restricted. And it's definitely impacting the economy in many, many different layers and levels. And definitely one of the hardest hit industry is the hospitality and travel industry sector. But I think there's a lot of confidence that you're still seeing in people that are investing in that space to believe that we will come through COVID stronger than where we were when we went in.
Yeah. So let me hold you down to a date then. So when do you think we'll be getting on a plane to the US and having a holiday there?
I would hope that by mid next year, that we would be at least able to get out without the harshest restrictions around the quarantining. But I think that if we are effective in this rollout and we get at least 70% of our population vaccinated, if that all meets the government's objectives, I think we could start to see a little bit more international travel come to pass. Hopefully I'll be on a plane into America or Europe. I've got a wedding to attend in Italy in September, so let's pray.
Yeah, no, fingers crossed. Well, I think if you've got a valid business reason, you can get out, or if you're going for 3 months, then you can get out. I mean, the challenge that we hear about is getting back in, but if you can afford a first class ticket, that's not such a challenge because the airlines will put you on and give you the
slot. Yes.
So, but that, you know, that's tough, and it's heartbreaking for, you hear stories about, you know, fiancés who are overseas and can't get back and they don't have enough money and they haven't seen their other half for years, or, you know, new parents that haven't seen their kids for a year. And I mean, that's terrible.
It's just awful. It's awful. You've got to be able to repatriate your people and make them a priority. But unfortunately, I think that there's different brushes and strokes for different people based on how wealthy you are.
Yeah. All right, look, I think we're just about at the end. I wanted to ask you about the summit group that you're part of. Mm-hmm. You know, because we've had a few of the summit members on the podcast. So we've had Melissa Widner and James Ferguson and quite a few others that I haven't mentioned. But you were one of the first ones that, you know, so that for those that don't know, Summit Group is a group for late stage CEOs, and it's peer-to-peer networking and education. So you basically get together with a group of your peers that kind of understand what you're going through and help each other through it. You're one of the crazy original 19 that agreed to our sales pitch. You know, it's, hey, we want you to pay some money to join this club that doesn't exist and it's going to be great. Trust us. So, I mean, why did you do that? And, you know, why do you think as a CEO, that peer-to-peer collaboration is so important?
Well, I think for any founder, I think one of the hardest journeys is being a CEO and leading your ship, and it's actually a pretty lonely space. There's not a lot of people in your general circle that you can really talk to, get guidance from, talk about the same pain points that you've gone through or are going through that can give you some sense of perspective. I think joining the Summit Club, there's such an amazing caliber of people that are doing so many incredible things. And whether it's you're looking at employment share schemes, whether you're looking at capital raising, who, how, what, when, what have they gone through? What should you be looking at metrics? I think it's almost like a pressure test of people that go, it's a sounding board where you feel it's a safe space to talk without being judged, without being in a situation where you're trying to compete. It's a place where I think honesty is at the heart of it, where often people feel they never have a chance to be vulnerable in their own business world. And as much as there, I look at vulnerability is a strength, it's very hard to be because you never want to show weakness. You never want to show you've got problems. You never want to talk about the things that are really hard because you want to be seen as a successful CEO in your business. But the truth of the matter is, we go through very difficult times as a founder and as a leader and a CEO in a business. And you actually need peers to sometimes really help you through some of those, you know, terrains and to navigate through some journeys that you may not know how to deal with. And that I think the Summit Club has been amazing for. I think just building the camaraderie of other people going through the different life cycles of their journey and their product creations and opening doors and networking and just getting a warm introduction between friends and people that you know is so impactful for a founder. It's worth more than money. It really is.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, and when you asked me to join, and I think it was something that I felt, firstly, I was ready for. Secondly, that I wanted more so to have a group of people that I could reach out to and be comfortable engaging with. Because when you get that philosophy of peers coming together, it's not that you're trying to compete with each other. You're not there to do anything other than share experiences and help each other. And that's what I love about the Summit Club.
Yeah, great. All right. Look, thank you, Lauren, for sharing all of that with us. I knew you're, I love doing these because I always find out stuff that I didn't know. And it's just your journey's been so amazing and you've been so successful. And there's a lot more to come. I mean, I think, you know, Ivy's on a tear and I think it'll be a $1 billion business and not very long. So look, best of luck with that.
Thanks, Ian.
You know,
I appreciate that.
Everyone's here rooting for you in the sidelines. So, but before we go, we do need to talk about the quick fire questions that I sent over to you. You know, try and get a little bit behind the, you know, what goes on in Lauren Hall's head. So yeah, do you have a favorite book you want to share with us?
Look, I think one of the books that I found really valuable for me at the level of which I found where we were in scaling was Scale or Fail by Alison Maslin. She's really good in terms of really positioning the ability for rapid growth. I think it's a great book for all founders to read, particularly if you're in that scale journey. Because a lot of people, it's fine to build a business. It's very different to scale it and how you approach those things. And I think it's a great set of fundamental tools that people could rely on. I think that's a book that I would certainly recommend.
All right. And thank you. What about podcast? Do you get to listen to podcasts?
Yeah, not often enough, but I'm constantly being hammered by my son with Joe Rogan's interesting podcast. And I think the one that I saw that was really interesting to me was with Elon Musk. And when he was smoking his weed and it set all the markets crashing and crazy. But certainly I haven't spent enough time on podcasts and I'd love to do more of it. And I think that there's merit in hearing other people's journeys as you learn. And I would love to be able to get some more podcasts myself just to be able to, you know, really get recommendations. And I know you've done, well, how many was that? 178?
About 150, I think.
Yep. And journeys are certainly fantastic because you can learn so much more, but I need to dedicate some more time to that myself.
Yeah. Yeah. And I haven't actually watched that one where Elon, you know, cracked out a spliff and started puffing away. You know, maybe that could be something we should do to get more out the guests, give them some MDNA or
mushrooms. Imagine what would come out. You would have a completely different set of context to your podcast, Ian, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, we'll keep that up our sleeve as a new idea for a future format.
Yeah.
Now, what about tech CEO? Do you have a favorite CEO?
Look, I suppose any person in the tech world, and particularly coming out of Australia, I think the iconic guys that you look at, and it's not just guys or women, it's regardless, you've got Michael and Scott from Atlassian, I think are incredible founders and that you look at and you admire and you want to aspire to be like. And I certainly, having had the privilege of meeting both of them, we have a very high expectation. We would love to be, type founders like that, and certainly look up to that type of delivery on a global basis, I think are amazing.
Yeah, no, I love those guys. I think it's just astonishing what they've done. They're still down to earth. I mean, for people that are worth over $20 billion each, their feet are on the ground and they know what they stand for. They know what they want to build. And it's tough to put your head into what that might be like to be in that situation. But yeah, they definitely are the shining light for this sector.
Yeah, definitely.
What about a favorite app? So this is when you open your phone and you're not reaching for email or your diary.
Slack. We've moved our whole company onto Slack. we've got someone on Slack. Everybody's on Slack because I think it just the comms and the dashboarding and the things that you can do in terms of projects and teams, I think is really valuable. And it's just a great comms tool and you can access so many different things on so many different levels. And it's a very well utilized tool, particularly started out in my dev team. It's gone rolled out across my whole operation. And it's just going to become, I think, an everyday thing that you do, it's going to be part of like having your cup of coffee in the morning.
Yeah. Like I got to say, like we, again, with Innovation Bay sort of resisted a bit and it might have been down to me when it was a small team, like probably sub five, having the breakout channels and everything else didn't really make much sense. And we kept defaulting to WhatsApp. But as the team is growing, like we're over 10 people now, Slack has proved to be fantastic. I'd agree with you. It's just a terrific tool just for that. I mean, especially when you're working at home. I mean, it's just nice to jump on and share some banter, as well as the work stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, like any team, I think you have to find good ways to communicate and it's really hard sometimes and that you have enough time to do that, particularly with the different areas and particularly as you grow, it gets harder when you have more people. Now we're going to be close to 100 people and on different time zones and different worlds and everybody's communicating. Yeah. You've got to have a way that you've got a single point of contact.
Now this question might bleed into the last one, but productivity tips or productivity tools, what do you use?
What is one of the things that we've just actually implemented was monday.com. Because we've actually deploying all the different projects, not only from building the pipeline of the entire IPO process across my finance team. So I've built up channels, the same as all of our marketing strategy for deployment, because what we're doing is compressing all of our growth tactics and, all of the different components that make up our strategy within monday.com, so that people who have to deliver content, it's a fantastic tool to be able to allow you everybody to collaborate on it, everybody with actionable insights and measurability, and to drive performance to ensure that things are met on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. Like we also use monday.com across Innovation Bay and actually Gelix as well. And it's a terrific tool. It's just got better. I mean, they've raised a ton of money. It's really a company and they've done really, really well. And the features are just getting better.
So, they are, absolutely. I think it's a great tool.
All right, second last question. Like, do you have time to watch telly? If so, what TV show do you?
Funny enough, I'm constantly watching Bloomberg, okay, because I like to see how companies are performing. And I mean, like, come on, get my head off of business. But I have a tendency to go towards shows like, I love watching The Dragon's Den and all these entrepreneurial pitches because I'm going, I wouldn't do this. I change those terms. Maybe it's because I look at all the entrepreneurial pitches and how they navigate through a lot of these sharks and dragons that exist in funding. Typically, not huge amounts of time, but I think that there are lots of shows and I think people might think it's a bit spacey, but I like to watch a lot of these, ghost shows, which are on at like 11 o'clock at night. Because that's the time that I'm finally crawling into bed for that half hour. And, and that's pretty much as I get to.
All right. No, that's cool. And very last question. So if you did get called by the TED organizers and got asked to do one of those 15-minute talks, what would you focus on?
Now, that's an interesting thing because I actually was approached and I was meant to speak for TEDx. And
There you go. So you know the answer.
Yeah. And I think that I think there's different topics that you want to talk about. The most important thing is when people look at that type of content is to ensure that you talk about the journey, you can deliver the memorable components, but the experience and actionable points for the takeaway. In TED, I think you know, there's such a lot of topics to cover. If I have to look at it, I would talk about the courage, the resilience, the endurance around delivering success within a person's world and what it actually takes to be successful and having the fundamentals right from the beginning so that it can prevent a lot of people on some of the painful journeys that most entrepreneurs go through. And that's one of the things that I was considering talking about. And I think if you can set a journey around, you know, confidence, capital, courage, community, and work on the four C's of the pillars of strength to be successful, that's probably what I'd talk about.
That, Lauren, is a great way to end this conversation. So look, thank you. That's been great. Really enjoyed that. And I think there was a ton of great takeaways for me and hopefully the audience too. So thanks for carving out your time. Best of luck with the business.
And thanks, Ian.
Yeah, we can all find you at ivy.com, ivvy.com.
That's it. And look, reach out if anybody wants any questions or we can share what we're doing. Love to be able to provide some insights. And thanks, Ian, for having me on this podcast. I hope I shared a little bit of my journey. It's crazy and it's only going to get crazier. But hopefully we can also be a shining light for lots of other women as well, because we need some role models to really show that when you dream, dreams are possible. It just takes an army to help you.
That's right. Anyway, look, thank you. And we'll see you soon.
Take care. Bye.